We present For One Horrible Moment by Peter Bradshaw. Episode 4. Initiation.
Previously on For One Horrible Moment. As a young boy growing up in the Fens, I have developed a sexual fascination with an older local girl called Susan, who bears a striking resemblance to me. Our relationship is consummated in a secluded Fenland copse, but the enigma about her is so unbearable that I resolve to know the truth, no matter how traumatic that may be. Every Wednesday evening, my father would give a religious reading for members of the village. It was usually sparsely attended, and seldom more so than when Father was giving his novel view of Saul of Tarsus, who on his conversion to Christianity famously changed one letter of his name to become Paul. Father believed that the apostle's name was in fact originally Sam, and the resulting change had much more worrying implications. It was after one such evening that I determined to ask Father about Susan and what her connection was with our family. The reading finally comes to an end, and the heckling and shouts of disbelief die away. As the crowd resentfully disperses, Father descends from the lectern he has erected in the library, wearing the dark ecclesiastical robes to which he is not entitled. I accost him, and gulping and quavering with fear, I demand he tell me the secret of Susan. He pales, and motions me to follow him into his private chamber, where he keeps the equipment for changing his blood. We are never let into this room during the day, and I know that something momentous is about to take place. This chamber was where my father worked on some of his inventions. For some months every year, the room was his centre for research into the tear duct, and experimental subjects would be taken into a private lavatory booth, where they would be told to produce enough tears to fill a small beaker. Papa would discreetly leave a stash of provocatively unhappy books and magazines in there to help each subject produce the liquid, including a tape with a theme to love story. And then there was the prototype of his reverse electric blanket, a device for cooling a bed down in the hot summer months. It was as different, Papa used to tell us, as a refrigerator was from an electric oven, but its one drawback was that it needed 12 large canisters of liquid oxygen to be kept by the bed. Father had to suspend work on the reverse electric blanket when he tried it out on Mr. Gerald, the gardener, who accidentally left it on all night, and his wife had to have her frostbitten leg amputated at the hip. At the end of the room, Papa removes several padlocks attached to a tiny door, the one which many and many a time he has forbidden Edward and myself to approach, and now here he is, motioning me to go through it. Inside, I find a bizarre machine, a thin, uncomfortable-looking bed with two electrodes at one end, and part of a bicycle, apparently designed for generating electricity.
"This is why you can remember nothing of Susan," says Papa curtly. "She was simply our au pair, but when she had to go away at the end of that summer at Hunstanton, you became unnaturally depressed, so I had to give you electroconvulsive shock therapy."
I point, horrified at the contraption. "With that?" I gasp.
"Certainly with that," he replies calmly. "There was no ECT on the National Health in those days, lad, and we couldn't afford to go private. In 1969 we had to make our own entertainment. Find our own treatment."
He pats one of the electrodes fondly.
"I strapped you into the unit, and then your mother pedalled away to get the voltage for a convulsion. It worked a treat. You cheered up no end. Except, of course, you were propelled off the mattress and hit the wall over there."
Here he indicates a mark on the wall at the other end of the room.
"And, of course, you lost a fair bit of medium-term memory."
I stay silent for some moments, stunned.
"Has this information depressed you at all, lad?"
he asks. I say, sullenly, that it has.
"Well, never mind. Look."
From a nearby workbench, he produces what looks like a small electric buzzer. He explains that it is his new mini-ECT device, suitable for minor cares and trifling woes. Before I can stop him, he clamps it to my head and bzzzt. After the initial shock, I have to concede that I really do feel remarkably cheerful. We go happily out of Papa's private study together and down to the dining room, where Mama has prepared supper. Edward is already seated, and Father hails him bluffly before taking his position at the head of the table to say grace in his usual loud, clear voice. In a matter of moments, Grace comes bustling through from the kitchens with the food. But my electrically induced sunny humour soon disappears when Mama asks me how I wish to celebrate my 13th birthday, which is next Saturday. On my previous birthday, Mama had somehow managed to hire Mr. Terry Jacks for the occasion to sing his popular hit Seasons in the Sun. When our game of knockdown ginger had come to an end, and the unfortunate tabby cat had been peeled off the road, we children were brought back into the playroom for the entertainer, as Mama put it. We were hoping for a sprightly conjurer, and it was with some dismay we saw Mr. Terry Jacks setting up his stool, amplifier, and semi-acoustic guitar, and begin to play his interminable maudlin ballads. The only person who had really seemed to enjoy Mr. Jacks was Mama, whose head moved in an expressive figure of eight throughout each song, her eyes dreamily half-closed. Later, when I went into Ed's bedroom to fetch my cricket bat and garden stumps, I had found Mama and Terry Jacks copulating with a strange air of tragic desperation. Whether my father knew of my mother's affair with the melancholy 70s balladeer, I don't know. And anyway, he gave no hint of any such knowledge, remaining downstairs, superintending a vigorous game of pin the tail on the donkey, played with a real donkey. Father brings the flat of his hand sharply down on the table and calls for silence.
"This year," he says, addressing me, "your birthday will be a rite of passage into adulthood."
"I think he's had his rites from what I understand," says Edward, rolling his eyes in the most unbecomingly camp way and fitting a cigarette into a holder. He is quelled with a glance.
In truth, I had every reason to dread my 13th birthday. In those days, my father was Lord Lieutenant of Cambridgeshire and had an ancient droit de seigneur on the stamp collection of every 13-year-old boy in the parish, a privilege he took very seriously indeed. I remember we were cantering past one of the villagers' cottages. We heard, "Happy birthday to you," and my heart would sink to see 13 candles through the window. Immediately my father would burst in, demanding his philatelic rights, and the poor people's mean and lowly parlour was strewn with stamp hinges, as Papa would fight with the boy, a contest which consisted largely in pulling each other's jumpers. There was no guarantee whatever that Papa would not insist on confiscating my own paltry collection, assembled largely from giveaway packs from Skyray lollies. Sensing my reservations, Papa frowns, and for the first time I can see the faint scorch marks on his temples. Has he been overdoing it with the mini ECT, I wonder? Presently he speaks.
"You will spend your birthday with Edward and myself in the Highlands."
Almost at once, a great rush of euphoria overwhelms me. I am to be spared the usual embarrassments of a traditional birthday in the Fen, and we are to go up to my father's holiday cottage in Scotland. I have been relieved of my burdensome virginity by a glamorous older female, and I have my father's word that there is nothing unnatural about the liaison. I feel as if adulthood stretches out before me like a lush and glorious landscape over which I am to swoop like a sensual and predatory hang glider. "Oh, Papa, that will be marvellous," I say.
"Won't it?"
he agrees.
"We'll be travelling up there in the plane."
Our family aeroplane was a craft of Papa's own design and construction, which had the one signal disadvantage of being quite unable to leave the ground. Papa insisted that this was simply because it failed to get a long enough take-off run in our grounds, and he would taxi it out onto the main road. Effectively, we would drive up to Scotland in a huge and ungainly car, fitted with large, badly moulded wings, which were a grave danger to other road users, and which, indeed, caused two minor accidents. Edward and I were strapped miserably into our passenger seats, while Father, our pilot, was up ahead in the cockpit, singing Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines. Thus it was that we arrived in Scotland. Papa's Highland retreat was on the banks of Loch Ochwa Ochwa, a tract of water very little used by other holiday-makers for fishing or water sports, perhaps on the grounds of its strange guttural name, and perhaps because, despite the fact that the loch was in the midst of the most stunning countryside, and its waters a brilliantly clear blue, it was only 6 by 4 feet large. I have brought along my dog, Jif Moose, who I have to call in order to stop him trying to dive into the loch. I shout,
Jif! Jif Moose! Jif! Jif Moose! Jif! Jif Moose! Jif Moose! Jif!
But it is no good. The impulsive old dog jumps into the crystal-clear waters of the loch and emerges 5 minutes later with a brace of salmon between his teeth.
Well done, lad! Papa shouts.
Edward and I are less enthused. The terms of our cottage rental forbade fishing in Loch Ochwa Ochwa, and Jif's actions were sure to sour relations still further with Mr. McBride, our landlord's agent, a tough, wiry Scot and fierce nationalist, who did not find my father's unionist views congenial. We had got off on the wrong foot the previous year, when Father suggested he might change his name to Mr. McGroom, in case people assumed he was homosexual. Mr. McBride hurries up to us, as we feared he would.
You know you're not supposed to fish in Loch Ochwa Ochwa,
he barks.
Ah, Mr. McBride, says my father pleasantly. It's a pleasure to be back here in North Britain, where people like you challenge gender stereotyping by wearing dresses. And you can rest assured that if oil is discovered anywhere in the North Sea in the next 5 years, the local communities round here won't see a penny of the profits.
Bastard!
Shouts Mr. McBride and stomps away. I do enjoy a bit of banter, says Papa, as he opens the door to the cottage. Edward and I follow him in, and Jif Moose scampers in behind us, the salmon twitching and thrashing in his mouth. The little cottage is as neat as ever, though the ceilings are rather low, as Father has modelled its construction on the dwarves' cottage in Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, even down to the organ in the corner. My bed is instantly recognisable because of the thick rubber sheet that he has wrapped 5 times around it, and the electrical bell device underneath it, which he has furthermore linked up to a flashing light. I pray it will not be needed. We all place our luggage down, and Father turns around to look us both in the eye.
Tonight you become 13 years old, son, he says to me, and I have decided it is time you found out the truth about yourself.
Something about the expression on my face. Edward told me later it was similar to the expression on the faces of the policeman guarding Lee Harvey Oswald when Jack Ruby shot him. Indicates to Father my mental perturbation. I stammer, but Father, you've already told me the whole truth about my past, haven't you? Father says nothing, but begins to lay the table for supper. Midnight was approaching, and the hands of the old clock were narrowing and converging implacably at the top of the dial in their dire, uncanny embrace. Now, the truth about Susan would finally be revealed.
For One Horrible Moment was written and narrated by Peter Bradshaw. The producer was John Naismith.
And the last episode